You're listening to the Restaurant GM Podcast, hosted by the GM coach himself, Scott Stanfield. With over 25 years of experience in the restaurant industry, Scott has been through the fire. He's hired the best, fired the worst, saved failing restaurants, and boosted morale in culinary chaos. You'll learn how profits are poured by the glass, customer service is always served hot, and emotional intelligence is the manager's special. Tune in for leadership tactics that cultivate a winning culture, hiring practices that retain a loyal and hospitality-driven team, and personal development that will take your bonus, your restaurant, your brand out of the red and into the black. Here's your coach, Scott Stanfield.
Today's guest is a certified executive chef, a certified culinary educator with an MBA, an author of three books, a consultant working to bring chef-level food to hospitals, and the host of his very own award-winning podcast called Business Chef. Sean Boucher, welcome to the Restaurant GM Podcast.
Oh, my good man. Thank you for having me.
No, it's my pleasure. You've had me on your show a couple times, and it's time to return the favor.
I love it. Any chance I get to talk to you, I am all about.
Same here. We met on LinkedIn. You used to put a post up a long time ago, I think about just over a year ago, asking for anybody to be on your show. And it's before I had started posting anything online. And I said, yeah, I'd love to be on a podcast. And that's how it started.
And here we are.
Here we are. Now you're over 100 episodes on your podcast, and I'm at the beginning of mine.
Which is great. The beginning of any journey, right? The single
exactly.
Step.
Exactly. So origin stories, that's a great segue. So origin stories are a huge interest to me. And so I'm curious how you got started in F&B and what led you to be a chef?
Man, well, good question. It's kind of interesting because I never anticipated I would be a chef. I didn't set out to be a chef. I really wanted to be an artist of some kind. I love to make things with my hands. I love to, you know, step back and say, wow, I made that. And I had taken just about every art class that I could in high school. And my high school guidance counselor said, you know, you ought to go take a class up at the trade college. You know, you'll get high school credit, college credit will pay for it. And I thought, well, yeah, sure, why not? So I'm looking through the course catalog and I see culinary arts and I'm like, oh, right, an art class. I'm going to be doing watermelon carvings and ice sculptures. And well, that obviously was not the case. I got in the very first day and the instructor's like, okay, well, lunch for 250 in about 3 hours. And I was like, what did I get myself into? But, you know, they say that timing is everything. In your career, in your business. And that was definitely the case for me. This was back in the late 90s when they had, the NBA had its first lockout. And at the time I was working in Salt Lake City, Utah. I was working for the Utah Jazz, or I had an opportunity to go work for the Utah Jazz. And the NBA lockout had happened. So all the cooks that were supposed to start in October, November, went and found other jobs, and all of a sudden the owners and players agree and say, hey, great, the season starts in January. And the chef out there was basically like, if you can breathe, I will hire you. And so I went down there. My chef instructor was like, look, if you go down there, this is a great opportunity, once in a lifetime opportunity for somebody in your position. If you go work down there, I will give you credit for working here. So I was like, oh, this is great. So I'm getting high school credit, I'm getting college credit, and now I'm getting paid to go work. So I went down there, very first day, cut the tip of my finger off, dropped a knife in my foot, spilled hot turkey juice down my front and back, like all in like the first half hour. And so the chef there at the time was like, man, just go home. You're not going to survive. And I was like, no, chef, I can do it. I can do it. I can do it. He said, no, seriously, go home. You've lost a lot of blood. So I went home, came back the next day, and he ended up taking me on as his apprentice. And I spent the next 8 years with him, kind of jumping around from the arena at the time. And then we moved into a hotel, worked at a hotel for a little while, and then we moved into some different fast casual chains and things, and it was a lot of fun. I learned a ton, and he was really the one that kind of helped me craft this message of you know, food service is an art, but it's also a business. And so, you know, I owe a lot to him for not only letting me get in initially, but then also keeping me in. I mean, I had worked for a few years before I got to the arena. I cleaned a butcher store meat department at night, and I've got, man, stories galore there. But yeah, that was my real first start in hospitality and food and beverage.
Wow, that's a great story. You know, working an MBA in the kitchen there. I've been to that arena. I worked down the street at the Hilton Salt Lake City Center. Was the director of restaurants there, and we donated some player of the game gift certificates for the players to come in and eat at the Spencer's for Steaks and Chops. So I got tickets and got invited to go to the 100K Club, and I've been to the 50K Club and all of those things. And so seeing the massive production that goes on in that operation, I can only imagine your first job and experiences that was going on. I can't even imagine what it was like, how it opened your eyes to what was possible in this industry.
Well, I think more than anything, the lesson that I learned was when it came to dealing with celebrities and it came to dealing with, you know, well-known people, because, you know, I was a teenager when I was working there. And so we had bands like Aerosmith and the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC and Britney Spears and all these people that were really big at the time coming through there and giving these sold out concerts to, you know, 18,000 people. And, you know, everyone would look at these guys like, oh, ooh, ah. I remember when the Backstreet Boys came through and there were literally girls fainting in the hallway and security's having to pick them up. And, oh man. And I just remember thinking to myself, like, these guys are not that big of a deal. Like, I was always the one downstairs in the room cooking for them, because they always had exhibition stations set up where we were doing omelet bars in the morning and pasta bars for lunch and carb prime rib at night. And so I was generally one of the guys that was in there for these concerts. And what I learned, though, was that these are just normal people. Like, I remember watching the Backstreet Boys, for example, come through, and I didn't recognize them at all, because when they come through in that setting, they don't have any makeup on. They're not all dressed up. They're just these like shy, quiet, kind of self-conscious people, just like a lot of the rest of us are. And so they would come through and they would eat and, you know, they would joke around. You got to see them in a different light. And then, you know, and a lot of them had acne and beer bellies and just things that you didn't see. And then they go into hair and makeup and they become this new person, and they go out on stage and everyone's like, ooh and ah. But I got to see them at a very vulnerable point, very real point. And that was probably the biggest lesson I learned, you know, not only doing volume. I mean, we fed 18,000 people for every game, and, you know, those concerts were no exception. That we had suites and, you know, we just had all sorts of things. It was a multifaceted business. But the biggest thing I learned there was just that celebrities are people too, and they want the same things we want, you know? So anyway, that was probably the biggest lesson I learned working there.
That's a great lesson to learn in the beginning, because that's a tough one. You know, over the years, you know, working in nice fine dining steakhouses, I've had my fair share of celebrities come through, and it's not always the easiest piece to go up and talk to them because they're so guarded. You know, especially in Park City where we had Sundance and, you know, all the different times, it's a great lesson to learn. You're blessed to get that very early on at 19. That's a great one. So the next question is, how'd you go from getting sent home on day one to being an apprentice that lasted 8 years on day two?
Well, persistence. I mean, really, that's what it was a lot of other people would have said, you know, I literally left a piece of my finger on this cutting board. I've been bandaged up. Like, it's just not going to work. And I still take this with me today, is that I've always felt like failure is what you make it. If you make failure failure and you walk away from it, you don't learn anything, and you absolutely failed. But if you view failure as just part of the process, you view failure as a stepping stone to the next thing, then that's really what makes the difference in a lot of people. Is failure is necessary. And if you see it as necessary and you see it as inevitable, then you view it differently. And I think too many people view failure as failure. And it didn't go right. It didn't go the way I wanted it to. I'm going to give up. It's, you know, if you read any success story, they failed and they failed and they failed until one day they didn't. But from all of those failures, they learned something. I have had restaurants that I've been in charge of, that I've owned, that I've operated, that have failed. And in more than one sense, financially, whatever. And, you know, there's always a story behind it. But at the end of the day, it was a failure. And it because it was not the outcome that we set out for. The part of it, though, that I take with me is that the reality is they were not failures. They were lessons that I had to learn to be able to get me to the next level. And so when I had a vision for myself and my career, I had to be persistent. I had to fail, and I had to fail over again. I had to be more persistent. And as I did that more and more, and I saw it as a learning curve, and I saw it as, you know, a journey and not necessarily a destination, that's when things really changed for me. And I think that's one of the things that's really different from people that are getting in this business nowadays, because nowadays we want instant gratification. We want to come in as a server on day one and be an assistant manager by day 10. Like, it just doesn't work that way. You've got to be willing to pay your dues and sacrifice and, you know, really do those things. I was told very early on it was going to take me years to get where I wanted to. And so automatically my barometer was set to years, not days, not weeks, not months, but years. So when I was promoted into a sous chef position, within the first 2 years, I was ahead of the game in my mind. But you know, it was only because of my persistence and those lessons of learning and failing that I took with me that really got me there.
That's a great point. That, you know, paying your dues and earning your stripes and all of those things are, you know, they're lost on a lot of, you know, a lot of people, and we end up blaming it on a generational piece. But, you know, in my opinion, I remember my dad's generation complaining about Gen X, which is you and me. I mean, we're relatively the same age. So the baby boomers complained about our generation, and now the millennials are getting it. And soon, very soon, Generation Z is going to get something. Somebody's going to start complaining about them. But what I'm seeing is more about is age related. You know, people are aggressive and when they're younger and kind of don't know when to keep their mouth shut. And, you know, so I'm getting a lot of questions of how old do you have to be a server, and, you know, or how long does it take to go from host to server, you know, those type of things. And all of those are, well, there's a state law on how old it has to be a server, but how long is it going to take you? That depends. It really depends on you, really. Because I think there's a maturity level that goes in with all of those things. Now, my story is a little bit different. I went from dishwasher to manager in 90 days, but I was transitioning out of a racing career and worked in manufacturing, and kitchens are really manufacturing facilities. And so I was able to really work my way up really quickly and use a lot of skills and transfer skills from a previous life, so to speak, into restaurants and move up quickly. But then that's when the real work began, because I never had served or hosted or bartended or managed for anything other than a little small racing team. You know, moving to that was a big learning curve for me in that. But what I want to talk about now is your podcast. Let's start there. Where can our listeners find your show?
Good question. I obviously love the topic. businesschef.org is the website, and that's where you can find a lot of the information out about it. We're on all the different platforms, so Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes. You can find us pretty much anywhere there. We've got a YouTube channel that we that we work with. All of our hashtags on social media are at Make Food Make Money. So on Instagram or Facebook, and then you can follow me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Chef Sean B. On LinkedIn, I'm Sean, S-H-A-W-N-B-U-C-H-E-R. You know, the thing about the podcast is the podcast was kind of an evolution of sorts, just like, the, you know, what we're talking about in our careers. I, by trade right now, I'm a chef by trade, but I gradually moved into education and consulting from operations. Part of that was I had a back surgery at 29, the ripe old age of 29, had my first back surgery, you know, all those years of hard floors and long hours on my feet. And I'm a big guy, so it just didn't do me a lot of good when it came to my back. So I had to find a kind of a way out, and I moved into education. I loved education, and as a consultant, you're naturally an educator, because as a consultant, your job is essentially to provide options for people to make a decision and give them the pros and cons to those options. And so as an educator and somebody who is passionate about the culinary arts and the food business, I gave a lot of advice, but I noticed that a lot of the advice was very similar. It didn't matter if I was in a hospital or it was in a grocery store, or I could have been in a gas station, I could have been anywhere. And I was giving a lot of the same advice and a lot of the same management strategies. And I mean, I travel all over, and it's always funny to me to go into new places, because people are like, oh, it's different here. You don't know what it's like for us. You haven't dealt with, and it's like, well, yeah, but I have. And here's the reality of it. You know, it doesn't matter if it's a tough union or we can't hire people or our food costs are out of control. Like, everybody's struggling with a lot of the same thing. And so what I wanted to do with the podcast is I wanted to create a way for experts to get on and not only talk about their careers, but ways that, you know, people could make food and make money. They could essentially learn some of the skills that they didn't have. You know, most of the people that I ran into that ran food service businesses, they were either incredible chefs that could cook circles around anybody, extremely passionate about the food, couldn't make a dime to save their life. Mm. Or you had these business people that would come in and they would say, man, look at the margins on this, or look at the opportunity here. Let's set up this business. Let's get it going. But their food sucked. so then it's like, well, we got to find a middle ground here.
Yeah.
You know, you got to be able to make decent food, and you got to be able to make money. And so that was kind of how that was born, was, you know, these different conversations I had so often, just trying to create an outlet or a resource for people to reach out to and hear from a lot of different professionals in a lot of different ways about how to kind of bridge that gap of making food and making money.
It's so needed. It's so needed. You're right square on the head. I remember a long, long time ago, one of my customers back in South Carolina is like, I want to open a restaurant. I have a great coleslaw recipe. And I was like, that has nothing to do with what I do, with what we, and if you want to build a restaurant around a coleslaw recipe, then go right ahead. Yeah,
good luck with that.
Yeah. Yeah. That was great. And so I've listened to a lot of your podcasts, and I want to know if you had to suggest just one episode for people to listen to, which one would that be?
Oh man. That's like asking me who my favorite child is.
I know. Maybe it's that. Maybe it's the recap one, what you learned from the first 100 episodes. Maybe that.
Oh, that's a good one. Well, I'll tell you, one of the ones that to be honest with you, the one I just finished is my favorite. But I say that every time I finish one, because I try. You know, and I'm fortunate to have people that help me with it, but it seems like I do it more for me nowadays than I do it for anybody else, because if there's a subject or a person or something that I want to know more about, I just reach out. I mean, there's a lot of people on LinkedIn, on Instagram, Facebook, whatever the social media platform is that I'll, if I see something that they're doing that I really like and I think that they've got value to bring, I'll just reach out to and ask them. And then that becomes one of my favorite episodes because I've just learned so much from it. But I think in general, if people were to start listening, I would say listen to some of the current episodes, because as with everything, man, I've learned a lot in this journey. The team that has worked with me and helped me with this, we've all learned a lot in this journey, and our episodes have gotten better. And so if you want to get a taste of what it's like currently, listen to one of the more current episodes. I think the sound quality is a little bit better. You know, we've taken some feedback from, hey, the music's too loud here, or, you know, hey, can we talk more about this? So I would say just listen to one of the more current episodes, but really scroll through them and look, because I think there's a lot of episodes out there that might speak to you more at different times. You know, we have an episode where we talk about what to look for when you're going to culinary school, or we have an episode of, you know, what you want to look for if you're having staffing issues, or how to manage your food costs, or, you know, different opportunities that you have at different times. You know, a lot of times we have different focuses at different times and different triggers. And so I would just say, look through it, see what's out there, see what really kind of strikes you at the time, because I think it's going to be different. I mean, I look through our catalog now and there's episodes that I'm like, oh, I need to go back and listen to that because I forgot what they said, or, you know, I didn't quite internalize that as much as I wanted to. But if you're just starting out to the podcast, listen to one of the current ones. Those are the ones that are a little better.
Yeah, that's great advice. I mean, you're developing such a wealth of knowledge and a catalog for people to be able to learn from in our industry. It's absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing.
That's the hope, and I appreciate that. That's what we're trying to do.
So let's talk about your book, your latest book. You got three of them, but let's talk about Food People Management.
Yes. And as you said that, I just realized that I forgot to send you what I was going to send you on that. So I will make sure to do that. But Food People Management was the progression from the podcast into a physical form. So same thing. We talked, you know, I learned a lot on the podcast, learned a lot from dealing with my different clients and customers and the different challenges that they had. And again, it was kind of the same recurring themes were coming up in different segments and at different times. And I finally got to a point where I just said, man, I gotta just kind of copy and paste a lot of this stuff that I've already done and put it into a concise format and just, you know, basically hand that to people. So Food People Management is a book that's based on a management formula that I came up with years ago and have since kind of tweaked and evolved. That management formula is standards plus accountability times consistency equals success. So we talk a lot about standards and what is a standard and how do you set a standard and how do you communicate standards, and then how do you hold people accountable to those standards? And obviously the most challenging part of doing that is being consistent, because and no 2 days are the same, and our challenges are always different from day to day. And so we always try to, you know, we try to do the things we're supposed to on a daily basis. It's just not always easy. And so again, like we want to set standards, hold people accountable to them, and do it consistently to equal that success. So the book is all kind of based on that, that premise.
Yeah. I totally love the way that, no pun intended, you boiled this down to a mathematical equation.
Yeah. Well, I have to give credit where credit's due, because it used to be standards plus accountability plus consistency. But my wife actually pointed out to me, she said, you know, isn't it the more times you're consistent, the better? And I was like, brilliant. I'm changing it to times.
Yeah.
So got to give it credit where credit's due.
Yeah. Well, wives are a great thing. And normally what I found is they're right. So
amen
to that. So what I want to do is actually see what your definition of success is. Let's start at the end. So a lot of times, you know, the answer, but you don't, you, you know, we're doing a little algebra. We'll put N equals plus, or, you know, or N plus accountability times consistency equals success. So how do you define success in a food and beverage or restaurant environment?
Well, that, man, that's a great question, because success is relative. You know, what is success to me may not be success to someone else. Also, what success to me today may not be success to me tomorrow. And let me give you an example of that. I'm actually working on a project in Eastern Nevada right now that is, man, it's a humdinger. It's a doozy. The goal of this project is not necessarily to make money in these restaurants. And that's been a really hard thing for me to kind of put my hands on and wrap my head around, because, you know, it used to be that success was success was success. If I was making money and it was at least this much, that was success. Well, as time's gone on, I've realized that there's a lot of intrinsic things that are success. You know, for example, in one of the restaurants that I was a partner in, we had a great run where we were profitable. We had a good staff that stayed on for a long time. And that was success. Like, we were happy, we were making money, but man, I was working like unbelievable hours just to make sure that it was humming along. And over time, it just wasn't sustainable. And so success to me was no longer the money or, you know, keeping people happy. It was me getting consistent days off and, you know, things like that. So I think anybody who's defining success, you have to define it differently at different times, and you have to, and, you know, again, it's all relative. But that's why I think success starts with whatever the mission of the project is and the values that you hold dear. Because in this project that I was talking about, the mission is really to build a community and really to create jobs, not necessarily to make money. So if the volume's not there and they're in the hole every month, they're okay writing a check. And again, that's just not in my DNA to say, well, man, we're successful because we're, you know, having to pay out every month. But the mission of the goal, or the mission of the project, we're accomplishing that, you know? And so those are the types of things that you have to kind of keep in mind, is that success is relative, and it's also dependent upon where you're at in your life and what those values are.
That's so true. I remember, you know, I find myself most of the time turning restaurants around. I'm becoming the turnaround specialist. And a lot of times it's success is moving the top line. It's not food costs. It's not labor costs. It's not even the bottom line. And then once you get where the restaurant's meeting its potential, you can start then really getting a couple half percent here or there, or on food cost, or really running labor lean once you've had some longevity in your staff, and the team is really, you know, it becomes a well-oiled machine. And, you know, and then next thing you know is not, you're still maintaining the top line. Your reviews are really high because the team's doing an amazing job and you got some really great people. And then all of a sudden the bottom line percentage just starts growing. And now all of a sudden, you know, everything's hitting on all cylinders, and it's just an amazing piece. So I agree with you 135% that it is relative, because it depends on what the operation needs or what the goals are, or those type of things. So it's,
well, and I just want to add that, I mean, it's a very astute observation that comes from experience. And I think too many people nowadays think that they can put success in a box, and they can say, well, it should be this, and this is what I expect, or this is what we want, you know. And that's the thing about it, is that you really can't define what success is until you know the path that you've got to trod, until you know what the mission of the project is, until you know what you need to do to get there. Like, success is going to be little milestones that are going to lead to that big milestone, but it really takes somebody who has been there to kind of mentor you through that. So that's that's one reason that I have a job, that you have a job, that a lot of us have these opportunities to really teach and preach and coach. What we do is that it takes time to really figure out what success is at what time in the process.
Exactly. I mean, because it's so difficult with all the distractions that happen day to day in our jobs to, you know, or the job of running a restaurant, whether you're a chef or you're a GM or, you know, any of those things, is to hit on every cylinder or hit every single KPI every single day. It's a tough job to do. And, you know, and that's one reason why I started doing it, giving back and started training, because I want people to know that, you know, from time to time, it's like food costs may not be the number one thing that you need to focus on. It may be top line sales, or it may be marketing, or it may be hiring. It may be, and then at times food costs may be the thing that, and controlling costs may be the number one thing, because you've already either things have gotten way out of whack, or, you know, you've got all the other pieces happening properly so you can take your time to focus on those things.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. And that again, that's the value of having somebody kind of hold your hand and mentor you through that process, is that the time value of money, you know, really what it comes down to is, do you have the money to give you enough time to learn how to do it? Or is it more worth spending a little more upfront and cutting down the time that it's going to take to do that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Mentorships or consultants or those type of things are ways to do that, or hiring somebody that's, you know, you're 25 years, I'm 26 years going on 27 years of doing this. So it can definitely speed it up for sure. Now your formula for success, really, it speaks to me. What it tells me is you put culture first.
I would say culture becomes part of the process. Like, you can't create a culture per se. The culture comes from the environment that you create. So if you can't say, well, our culture is this. Like, you have to live that, and your employees and your customers and things have to understand who you are and what it is that you stand for, and see you living it to really become that culture, if that makes sense. You know, it's not, we can't say this is our culture and this is what it's going to be. We're going to have, you know, casual Fridays is our culture, whatever. Like, culture is just a natural piece of the people that are there, the processes that are in place, the standards that you live by, the ethics, you know, all those things, that becomes the culture.
That makes perfect sense. So standards, right? You're a consultant. You actually spent a lot of time, or some time at least, teaching people in culinary school. So you've probably spent a lot of time drafting and creating, writing. What is the number one driver for standards, or what do you see is like a big linchpin in the whole standards process that you could tell us about?
Well, I think the biggest challenge when it comes to standards and creating standards and putting standards into play is communication more than anything else, because a lot of times we feel like we have standards and we feel like we communicate those standards, but the reality is we can have those standards, but again, it's all relative. So if I come to you and let's say that we have an employee who lives in a drug house, whose idea of clean is that there's no rats on the floor. You know, that's the environment they grew up in. That's what they understand is clean, is that there's no visible stuff on the floor and there's no rats running everywhere. So the place is clean, even though the reality is there's, you know, tons of stains on the floor and it smells bad and the walls are sticky and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Well, they just don't know an environment that's any different. So we create this standard that says, you know, we mop the floor. We sweep and then we mop the floor till it's clean. And then we go to that person, we say, we want you to sweep the floor and then mop it till it's clean. Well, that person's going to, you know, they're going to sweep the floor, but are they going to get every little bit up that we expect them to? When they mop the floor, are they going to use soap or are they just going to use water? Like, there's a lot of things that are missing in translation, that until we know where someone's point of reference is, we can't really train or coach them until we kind of get an idea of where they're at. And so when it comes to setting standards, we do these blanket statements of, well, I told them that they needed to mop the floor. Well, they did mop the floor, but they did it according to what they know. So really, when it comes to setting standards, is you got to go out and you got to handhold and you got to show them exactly the way you want it. And then that's where the accountability piece comes too, because if you show them and they don't get it, and you show them again and they don't get it on purpose, or they just don't want to, or et cetera, et cetera, then you've got to start holding them accountable to that. But most of the time as managers, we do ourselves, our staffs, everybody a disservice by not clearly communicating what the standard is. The other disservice that we do is we don't let our staff, our employees, our crew members, we don't let them have a hand in the process. Mm. We need to have their input. We need to have their buy-in. And there's no better way of getting buy-in to a process or to a standard than letting people have a hand in creating it. You know, if you open it up for discussion and say, hey guys, we're having a problem. Somebody keeps storing raw chicken on this top shelf in the walk-in. What can we do to get away from, you know, part of it is they've got to understand why. If somebody doesn't understand the why, they're less likely to do it. But once, if they understand the why, well, we put it on the bottom shelf so that it doesn't drip on everything else. It's got to be on the bottom. That's what the standard that we've set is that it's going to be on the bottom shelf and it's going to be on this rack, et cetera, et cetera. If you communicate those things and you walk them through it and everybody understands the why, they're much more likely to go through it. But we as managers, supervisors, leaders, we have to take the time up front to really communicate what those standards are. And not just assume that I had a piece of paper and I printed it up that says, we don't do this. And I stuck it on the wall. Well, great. It's, you know, it's another piece of paper on the wall that is just lost out there. You know, people walk past it. They might glance at it once or twice, but they're busy. They're not stopping to read random pieces of paper. It's way more than that. And that's where I see a lot of the breakdown in the standards is the communication and the upfront work that it takes to really teach somebody what your standards are and why you have those standards.
Yeah, I think that's one of the toughest ones. I mean, we even posting a message on hot schedules gets ignored. It's like, you know, somebody's smoking out back and it's like, what are you doing smoking here? And they're like, where am I supposed to smoke? I'm like, did you read the message on hot schedules? No. It's like, you know, that's a tough thing is communicating, you know, when you have, especially when you got a large crew, when you're getting above 50, is getting the message out to everybody, you know, in that. So I agree with you 100%, you know, is getting the message out, getting clear communication and all the ways that people are willing to accept the communication. And I couldn't agree with you more on that one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of it is just, it's the realizing that we have to take accountability as managers, that the buck stops here, you know, and if people aren't getting it or things aren't changing or processes isn't being implemented or followed, like we've got to take a step back and look inside and say, why isn't this happening? What have I not done? How have I failed my team? Because a true leader is a servant leader. They're a leader who is going to jump in and help where they need to, when they need to, how they need to. A lot of times I used to think, well, man, the only way I can help my team is by, you know, the line's going down in flames. I got to jump up there and start expediting. Well, sometimes that was needed. Other times I needed to go up back there and say, hey guys, what can I do to help? And a lot of times, you know what they'd say? Take out this bus tub full of dirty dishes. We keep keep tripping on it. Take out the garbage. It's overflowing. It's getting in the way. Like things that were like, oh, well, I'm the manager. I don't, you know, I need to jump in there and do this and that. No, listen to your team. Your team lives it all day, every day. They're as invested in creating a functional, easier work environment than anybody. So just listen to them, listen to their ideas, listen to their feedback and be the servant that they need, provide them the tools they need to get their job done. jump in when you need to, how you need to. And granted, there's going to be times where you're going to have to lay the law down. But for the most part, if you have people that really like what they do and know what they do and are have a vested interest in it, like, just listen to them. Just drop your pride and listen to your people.
That's great, great advice. And so I want to transition into the accountability aspect of the equation. And you mentioned servant leader. So accountability, servant leader, how does that fit together? And how do you hold people accountable and still have a positive morale?
Well, I think positive morale comes from accountability, because at the end of the day, you're going to have people, and let's face it, like, food service is full of people that have to work in it, not necessarily want to work in it. So at the end of the day, it's really difficult to motivate somebody who doesn't want to be there and who really doesn't care about what they're doing. So to hold people accountable, you also have to find out, like, what motivates them. To be a servant leader, you've got to figure out, like, why are they here, and what can I do to make things better for them, or what can I do to, you know, to be an effective leader? And, you know, that's where some of that accountability comes in, because you can set all the standards in the world and clearly communicate them. But if you're not holding people accountable to them, your A-team players that are buying into the standards and wanting to uphold them, they're going to see that you're not holding the B team or the C team players not accountable. And they're going to think, well, this is garbage. Why would I listen to, you know, why would I spend this extra effort and time upholding these standards if they're not going to be upheld by everybody? You know, if we all agree to this, but only half of us follow it, you know, that's it. I'm out of here. So I think a lot of times we think, well, I've got to be Mr. Nice Guy, otherwise my team's going to leave. Your team wants you to be consistent. Your team wants to know that when they come into work, what it's going to be like. They don't want to worry about, oh man, is my manager going to be mad? Are they going to be upset today? Is, you know, are they going to yell? Are they going to scream? Are they going to throw things? Are they going to be my best friend? Because a lot of times leaders and managers, they have these really high and low mood swings. You know what I mean? Where it's like, it's, you know, it's the greatest day on earth and we're hitting on all cylinders and I love you guys. And then the next day it's like, you guys are a bunch of turkeys. And, you know, it just is not like, you got to be consistent. And that's really what helps morale, is when you're consistent. Now, that's part of the servant leadership piece also, is that you have to be the kind of leader that really loves what they're doing, really loves your people and understands them and wants to help them, wants to give them the tools that they need to be successful. And when you do those things, when you're consistent and you look at serving your team and jumping in where you need to and leading by example, like, that's really what endears team members to you, because they know that you care, but they also know that when the going gets tough, that you're not going to back down from those standards that you guys have created as a team.
You know, that's such a great way of looking at it. You know, I find, you know, with my own leadership and management, that the more I focus on helping the, you know, individual team members accomplish what they want to accomplish, even outside of work, like to become a real estate agent or, you know, honoring their schedule requests so they can go to school, or if they got an audition to, you know, for a part in a movie or something like that, and really trying to help them along in those ways, the more that they want to give back to what's happening at the restaurant, and which has been amazing. And so the consistency, which is this multiplier in the equation, you talk about, you know, being consistent, like emotionally consistent as a manager, you know, like controlling your own emotions and instead of like having all these highs and lows, but being the same no matter what's going on around you. And so can you talk a little bit more about that, the importance of being consistent, you know, managing your own emotions and versus just like consistency in like recipes for, you know, how we cook a piece of salmon or how we make this macaroni and cheese. I mean, I think this is a big piece of it that most people don't really understand.
Well, I mean, emotional intelligence essentially is what it is. You have to be able to understand. Well, let me back up. You have to be the kind of leader you want to follow before you can teach somebody how to do it. And so, you know, when you as a leader are learning what it takes to lead, and you're leading by example, and you're doing these things that are good, you also have to be taking like mental inventory of like, okay, when I react, you know, when somebody comes to me and says, you know, hey, the walk-in's down, if I throw my hands up and say, you idiots, what did you do? Why did you break it again? Like, that's not being emotionally mature, you know?
No, not at all.
Yeah, I mean, that might be human nature to naturally do that. But the reality of it is when you do that, that just breeds more angst out there. That's gonna spread to other people who are gonna be like, yeah, so and so. It's always the line cooks that do it, or you know, the line cooks are gonna be like, oh, these idiot servers, if they just didn't do this and that. And you know, and it creates this animosity, and there's this negative energy and this negative tone that kind of just filters through everybody because you had this emotional reaction. So if you can kind of curtail those, and you can kind of back up a little bit and say, okay, you know, if somebody comes to you and says, walk-in's down, okay, how long has it been down? Like, you approach things objectively, because at work, it's hard not to be emotional. I get that. This is what we're passionate about. We spend a lot of time doing this. The reality of it is, though, is we're not doing anybody any favors by reacting emotionally. We've got to be objective, and we've got to just move forward. That's why when we let people go, if they don't work out, they don't live up to the standards, we have to let them go. We have to write them up. We have to document that. But it doesn't have to be emotional. It doesn't have to be about them personally. It's about their behavior. It's about, and most of the time, what I've found is that when you approach things objectively and you're able to come to somebody and say, look, you didn't follow through on this. We talked about this. I'm going to have to write you up. You're a great person. You're a great worker. I hope that this can work out to where we don't have to have this conversation again. But if it does, you know, unfortunately, our standard is that on your third, you know, your second or third fault or whatever, like, I'm going to have to write you up. And so when you do that, though, and you set those standards and people come to expect that, and then if they fail, chances are there's probably something subconscious going on where they probably really don't want to be there, and their behavior is just not, it's just not going to work out regardless of what happens. I had a really good coworker who used to say, I don't fire people. I set them free. I set them free to go do what they really want to do, because obviously if they don't want to uphold the standards, they don't want to be a team player. They just don't want to be there. So I set them free to go do what they really want to do. And I think that all comes back with emotional intelligence of being able to approach things objectively, being even keel, being, you know, non-emotional. That all plays a big factor into the morale and the consistency of our team.
That's so true. You probably have just as many stories as I do of when you actually have had to, as you put it, set people free. And then a month or 6 weeks later, you hear that they're working in another restaurant and they're working at a higher level, like maybe someone that was a runner is now a server at another restaurant, or the sous chef is now an executive chef somewhere, and you set them free and they've got a better job than what they had working for you. You know, it's amazing how that turns around that way.
It's that emotional intelligence. You have to realize that maybe you're not the best thing for them. Maybe this job isn't the best thing for them. And if they're not willing to come play at the level you need them to play, well,
yep.
Just be objective about it. It is what it is. Yeah. You know, you part as friends, but you just realize that it's not meant to be.
I remember the very first time I heard the term emotional intelligence. It was a talk by Dr. Travis Bradbury, who's a co-author in the book Emotional Intelligence 2.0. And he said, emotional intelligence is a greater indicator of success than IQ. So EQ before IQ. Yeah, my son and I, he was 12 or 13 at the time. And he looked at me and I looked at him, and we bought the book on Amazon. We, you know, went through a lot of those things. And you look at, you know, I'm looking at, I got a book right here. It's How to Perform Under Pressure, The Science of Doing Your Best When It Matters the Most. And it's got 22 tactics on how to alleviate pressure and the, you know, in high pressure situations. And, you know, it uses Michael Jordan as an example about how his final second shots are not any better than his season average. His playoff shots are not any higher than his season average. But the difference is that in the final closing seconds of a game, his performance doesn't diminish as much as the other people when you go back and look at the stats. And so it's about, people don't perform better under pressure, but the people whose performance diminishes the least are the ones that we look up to and we actually call by one name: Kobe, LeBron, Jordan, those type of guys. And so I have been focused on emotional intelligence for so long. And what I've found is that the more I've learned about my own emotional intelligence, I've been able to in turn teach that to my team and raise what I call the collective emotional intelligence of the overall team, front and back of the house, no matter what. And it also in these is allowed me to create space between an emotional reaction versus a logical response when in these accountability type situations as well. It's been, you know, emotional intelligence has been, it's changed me and, you know, even my family and people I've worked with, people I've coached as being the general manager coach or GM coach. It's life-changing. And so it's a huge piece of what I coach, what I do, and how I lived each and every day. And you're exactly right.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, but again, it just takes time and effort to really step back and say, maybe there's a better way to handle situations. Maybe there's a better way to view life. And really when you do that, that's when the change starts to happen. And that's when you start to be open to more things and, you know, more of those things come into your life and you're able to make those different changes. You know, it's the whole definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over. If you continue to manage a restaurant, a food service outlet, whatever it is, in a certain way, and you're getting the same results, then maybe it's time to start looking at yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things that really helped me understand why I needed to be more emotionally intelligent or just calmer in general was understanding about the social brain and what's called mirror neurons, and how there was a study, they actually put people who were blind in front of a computer and they would flash up images of people smiling or frowning, and the blind people looking at the screen or towards the screen would smile or frown matching that of what was on the screen. The minute that I step on the floor as a general manager at a restaurant, the staff knows whether to tighten up or lighten up based off my facial expression or body language or, you know, all of those things. And I'm like, if I stay, you know, in a great mood, positive mood, no matter what's happening around me, that's what my team's going to be. And then also that's what the guests are going to be. So it trickles down. Could change, one person could change the entire atmosphere of the entire restaurant based off this social brain that's just recently been discovered. And I think that really ties into what you're talking about in your consistency piece, you know, and maintaining, you know, someone's emotional intelligence, because it impacts everybody around you.
Oh, more than people realize.
Absolutely.
And once they realize how much it impacts them and how much it impacts everybody. I am reading a book right now called Originals that is just phenomenal. And one of the things it talks about in there is, you know, most of us think, well, the motivation for most people is self-interest. But the reality is a lot of times, he talks about this study that was done with doctors where in an effort to try to get them to wash their hands more often, they put up a couple of different signs. One said, washing hands helps you not get sick as often. And then another sign said, washing your hands helps patients not get sick as often. And the sign that said you, actually there was no change, but the sign that said patients, there was actually a 10% change where they washed their hands 10% more often, and they actually used 45% more soap. And so it's funny because, you know, a lot of times we think, well, so-and-so or this person or that person wants what's best for them. But there's just a subconscious kind of thing in all of us, I think, that realizes that we don't want to let the team down. We don't want to let others down. And if we can tap more into that side of our brain, into that kind of our psyche, that's really, really where we start to see some changes made.
Absolutely. That's what I really look for in interviewing. I look for people who care, you know, and we can, I literally, Sean, I could talk for another 3.5 hours with you about all of this stuff.
I know. You get the both of us going and we can't stop.
I know. So it's so important. The people who have a default behavioral based pattern that care or other centered, and it changes the entire makeup of a restaurant in very short order, very short order. And it's amazing. So I want to change gears because we could go on this emotional intelligence. People who know me know I can talk about emotional intelligence until the cows come home for sure. You touched on that you had back surgery at 29, and this business is a grind, a physical and mental grind. What kind of advice can you give to younger managers that are just starting out on their journey about how to take care of themselves, not only mentally, but physically?
Oh man, that's such a great question. I mean, this is what I should be asking you because you're the picture of this. But, you know, I would say a lot of times people in this industry, they turn to coping mechanisms versus like being proactive. It's a lot easier to be like, man, I had a hard day at work. I'm going to have a few beers. I'm going to get high. You know, all the different things that I face coming up in the business was alcohol is freely available. You could pretty much almost anybody in any circumstance and have access to some of these coping mechanisms. But the reality of it is that you take two steps back for every step forward. So yeah, you might feel good for a few minutes, but then that hangover the next morning is going to just absolutely destroy any type of efficiency that you have. And then you're going to get a reputation, and you know, there's going to be things that are essentially collateral damage to some of those decisions. And so really you've got to be proactive. You can't be reactive. You've got to get enough sleep. You've got to eat right. You got to drink enough water. Like, there's just so many things that I wish that I had done back in the day when, you know, as a teenager, you come into this scenario where you're like, wait, I can fill up a fountain soda as many times as I want and no one's going to say anything. You know what I mean? Like, that was not like, I was having to go spend 99 cents for one fill at the gas station. And now I don't have to do that. And so, you know, you learn though that those types of things, although kind of, you know, it's fun, it's exciting and it's new, but all those things just, they don't do you any good. And so you've got to be really proactive. You got to take care of yourself. You got to exercise, you got to get enough sleep. And those are all things that when I first got in this business that I really took for granted and eventually caught up with me, you know, wearing the right shoes, taking enough breaks, not trying to be Superman and saying, well, man, if you can do two bags of flour, I'm going to do three. Like, really? What good did that do me? It did me no good, because as I got into my 30s, all of a sudden it was like, man, life is just a lot harder when my joints ache and when I've got a headache all the time. And so anyway, but I could ask you the same thing, because I know that you are very proactive in your health and you do some incredible things and you've been able to see some great results.
Thank you. You're right. I claim to be a biohacker and all of those things. But going back to the very beginning, I was you know, in college, you know, at the University of South Carolina, I was a PE major, athletic training major, and I got a thin build. I mean, I'm 5'10". I was 157 pounds when I started in the restaurant business as a dishwasher. And the end of that summer, I was 185. I gained over 25 pounds because I was a line cook and I was working with a fryer. Throw a couple extra fried shrimp in there and, you know, and was snacking on that. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, leftover French fries. Or these are too cold to serve. And I mean, next thing you know, and I'm, you know, I'm drinking Mountain Dew and, you know, and getting my first cup of coffee. And next thing you know, you're eating more. And then you're leading the charge to the bar after it's all over with. It was pretty bad.
Empty calorie central.
Man, I've been 40 pounds overweight twice, and I had to learn how to manage that. You know, for me right now, it's intermittent fasting. In the last 7 years, I probably have breakfast 10 times or less. And the last 3.5, January will be 4 years. For the most part, I've been keto. And I know most people just recently started going keto, and that came about for different reasons. But I love the cognitive boost I get from being keto. I love it. It helps me be a better faster or fast easier because my body switches over to burning fat real easy. You know, I haven't had the type of, you know, like have back surgery or anything like that. And gosh, I had to rent some plates for a buyout the other day. And I was putting 150 plates in the back of my Mini Cooper. And, you know, a milk crate versus a full of plates is not light at all.
No,
it's like, that was like, okay, be careful. Don't pull a muscle. Focus, do this the right way. Lift with your legs. Really, really like, okay, I need to be there for, you know, for the team and my family and myself, and don't tweak anything. And so really making sure that happened, you know, obviously I the right shoes is one of the big things. Cause I hurt my left arch. Because we didn't have, you remember when we started, like we were talking before we started recording, we didn't have email and it wasn't really mandatory for non-slip shoes back then either.
Right.
And I was wearing just a pair of Reeboks and the chemicals ate the glue on the shoe and they came apart and I couldn't afford to buy shoes or to waste in the kitchen. I was a broke college student and, you know, I damaged my arch. And so for me, I'm like, wear the right shoes, take care of your feet. You're on them. You're going to be on your feet a lot if this is what you're going to choose to do. And, or at least it's just what you're doing till you get to whatever you want to be when you grow up. I found out stretching is a big, big piece, you know, of what needs to happen to really take care of yourself because we sit down a lot and we're moving a lot. We're standing up a lot. We're doing all these different things. We're picking things up, carrying things out in front of us, you know, lifting things above our heads, all those different things are. So stretching is a big, big piece of it for me right now. But that may have to do with the age I'm at, you know?
Too. Well, yeah. I mean, I think just you've got to learn your body and you've got to learn what your limits are. And in this business, it's very easy to push ourselves beyond our limits. You know, it's very easy to say, man, I know working an 8-hour shift and I've already put in 10, but they still need me for 2. My back is killing me. My legs are killing me. My knees are killing me. But, you know, I'm gonna push through. I'm gonna do it for the team. And not to say that there's not a time and a place for that, but you can't do that every shift. You can't be a martyr every shift and say, it'll be fine. You know, I can do it. I'm tough. I'm strong. Like, you know, part of it is you've gotta know when to say, this is my limit and this is what I can do. And I just don't know if I can do it. And if you can't do it, just be honest with yourself because, you know, burnout is a real thing. And if you are burning yourself on a regular basis, that's not a sustainable way to live.
It's not, you know, and I find myself on the weeks that I push myself harder that, you know, as I get to my Thursday and my Friday, which, you know, I find myself eating a little bit earlier in the day or maybe, you know, going in the walk-in cooler, looking for some raspberries or having a little bit more carbs or, you know, those type of things where as I get fatigued, as the week goes on, because I push myself so hard or too hard, that it's harder to stick to what I think my ideal regimen and my ideal diet is for high performance, because you're coping in a different way, or didn't I get enough sleep in there, or high stress is lending to those things. And so I think understanding the subtleties of, like, hey, I didn't get as much sleep last night. It's my Friday. You know, it's a Saturday night. Yesterday I worked 14 hours and I'm going to probably work another 10 or 12 today. And so, you know, just be having that awareness on where you're at in the day, and giving yourself the grace, giving yourself your own grace that you may not be able to do exactly what you need to do today to be your optimal self, but not putting yourself in a position next week, learning from the mistake of that as well.
Yeah. Sit down more, drink more water. I mean, there's little things you can do that will really make a big difference. And you may not see it right now, but you'll see it in 10 years. I mean, absolutely. there's just things that we just don't see until it's too late. And so, yeah, if I could do anything, that's what I would do. I would sleep more. I would take care of my body a little bit more, because, you know, who knows, it may have bought me a few more years.
Yeah. I just listened to a podcast, no pun intended, just listened to a podcast on sleep just the other day, and was talking about chronotypes, and are you an early bird? Are you a night owl? Or are you somewhere in between? There's four different chronotypes, or insomnia is one of those, and there's one in the middle. And understanding that if you're a night owl, if you go to sleep at the right time for your type of sleep, that you actually can get less sleep and still perform better than if you got more sleep but went to bed at a different time, at the wrong time for your type of sleep that you need. And I've been playing around with that and started, because I'm more of a night owl, and I've been going to bed about, instead of forcing myself to go to bed earlier, I've been going to bed a little bit later and getting less sleep and waking up more energized, which I thought was like, it was like I won the lottery or something. It was been pretty cool to go to bed later and wake up more energized than I was trying to go to sleep earlier and get up earlier. So, you know, looking at things like that too, I think are, you know, important, or emerging, an emerging knowledge base that we haven't really thought about really. And, you know, as a species really until now.
Right. Right. But take advantage of the knowledge that's out there, figure out what works for you and then do it. Don't just read about it. Don't just study it. Actually do it.
Exactly. All right. So I have a couple more questions here, and we'll wrap it up. For me, people is a huge, huge piece of this. And so we're in the people business, and I mean people that actually work in the industry, not the guest side of it. So what do you look for in people when you're hiring and looking to build a great team? And how do you find that in the people in the interview process?
Well, it's a good question. I think really one of the biggest things is attitude and desire. Because I think the skills, the different aspects of what we do can be taught, but it's the are you going to be somebody that I want to work with? are you going to be somebody who, when the going gets tough, is either going to burn out or just hate what you're doing and is going to bring other people down? So really one of the biggest things is attitude and desire. You know, what is your desire to be here? What is your motivation? Why are you here? Why are we talking? What is this going to do for you? Like, a lot of open-ended questions. I think one of the keys to interviewing is open-ended questions. You've got to get people talking. One of the things I love to do is I love to leave people alone for a little while. So like, if somebody comes in and we're scheduled for, say, a 2 o'clock interview, and they show up, you know, 5-10 minutes early, good for them. That's a great thing. But I may keep them waiting till 2:05, 2:10, And I may like send in spies. I may have people go talk to them or interact with them and see kind of how they interact. Do they just look at their phone? Do they give one word answers? Like, I try to look at a lot of those things that you can't necessarily put a gauge on. You can't say, oh, well, they answered this question so well, they get an 8. Like, there's just certain things that you want to really see of how they interact. If, you know, if people are coming up to them and talking to them, and they're energetic and they're talking back and they're happy to be there, chances are some of that's going to transfer into their day to day. You know, it's not going to be just the one thing. And so those are some of the things that I really look for when I'm interviewing, is I look for the things that people can't tell me. And I try to put them in situations that are going to tell me more about that. If I am talking to somebody and they do all the talking and all they want to do is tell me about all the amazing things that they've done and that they're going to do and how they're the best at everything, automatically I know that there's a lot of self-doubt, and I know that there's probably some different aspects of their past that maybe they don't want me to know about. Or, I mean, there's a lot of things that I've been able to learn over time that have taken years of experience to really be able to see and learn and know how to get out of people. But I would say, you know, kind of condensing it down, that's a really big thing for me, is the attitude and the desire, and then, you know, how they interact with other people and just, you know, are they going to be somebody that I want to work with?
You know, I stumbled on that piece that you talked about, leaving people alone, by accident one time. And so I don't do it all the time. I do exactly what you talk about. If somebody shows up early, I'm not going to be like, oh, they're here early, let me go start my interview early with them. I do the same thing. I want to see how they interact with the team as well. But what I started doing at one point is I would have them wait at the bar if they were over 21, and have the bartender start a conversation with them to see how they interacted with the bartender. It was by design, though. It was like the level one of the interview was how they interacted with the bartender. So when I took them back and we did the interview that, you know, that I, my official interview and, you know, all those things. And we would set them on their way after the interview was over, or set them up for a second interview. I would go back to the bartender and ask them, I was like, okay, how was it? What kind of questions did they ask? You know, when those type of things, if they were asking about money, or if they were kind of crazy or on their phone, like, you know, frantically texting somebody and having some sort of drama in their life, it was able to give this whole other context to the person that you never would get in an interview when they're trying to put their best foot forward and answer all the questions and not look stressed and all those type of things. So that's the very first time I've heard anybody else bring that up. And I wonder as I go on this journey, if this is going to come up more often, but it's been a great tool for me over the years.
Oh, absolutely. Me too.
Yeah. So, the final question here, this is the Restaurant Leadership Podcast. So I got to ask a leadership question. So how does someone move from being a manager to being a leader?
Well, that's a good question. I think you have to become, I guess the question is how do you become? You have to have an idea of what you want to be. You know, you have to have some sort of understanding or something to shoot for. I think too many people say, oh, well, I'm a great leader when I can bark orders at people, or when people have to listen to me, or, you know, something of that nature. The reality is that you almost have to have a mentor or some sort of person that you want to emulate, or at least qualities that you want to emulate. And so really, to go from a manager to a leader, you kind of have to know what that looks like. You have to know what it is that you want to do, or, you know, what it, you know, you see what I'm saying? Like, there's just gotta be certain things that you are reaching for. It can't be just pie in the sky. Like, well, I want to make more money. You know, I want to be able to boss people around, like, to really become a leader, you have to learn some of those lessons of like, what makes this place hum, and how can I be the best person for it? And who does that really well, and what qualities do they have, and how do they do it? That's been my experience, is I've had to have a frame of reference. I've had to have something to go after to really, you know, shoot for.
I love it. I love it. That's so impactful and so true. It you know, Chef, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show and giving us so much useful information and some solid tactics on people can use the next shift that they work.
Well, I hope so. I mean, that's the focus of what I'm doing nowadays, is I'm hoping to give back. I'm hoping to provide some tools, because like you said, when we got going in this business, there were a lot less options and there were a lot less resources for us to really have and grow from. And, you know, the hope is, again, we cut down the learning curve. We cut down the time that it takes you to go from being a host to a server to an assistant manager to a bartender, whatever it is, from a prep cook to a line cook to a sous chef. Like, if you can cut down some of that time and realize that, you know, some of the classes that you never get going to culinary schools, you don't get management classes per se. And when I say that, is there's a psychology behind it, and you have to understand the psychology behind it. So if you can just kind of, you know, put yourself forward out there and learn some of those things. And, you know, that's the hope of all this, is that a lot of people will say, well, you go into the kitchen, so I don't have to deal with any of that. Well, the reality is you're managing people, and regardless of what business you go into, whether you're front of the house, back of the house, whether you're food service or not, you're managing people. And so you've got to learn how to manage people. That's one of the biggest lessons that I think I've learned, is that the sooner you can manage people, you realize that the cooking and the serving is the easy part. And really what you're going to get paid the big bucks for is once you learn how to lead and guide and inspire people.
Exactly. Tony Robbins says that it's 80% psychology, 20% skills. And I literally spend that amount of time or even more on the psychology side of it. One of the books that made the biggest impact on me as a person, as a dad, as a husband, you know, as a friend, as a restaurant manager, is by Chris Voss. He's a former FBI hostage negotiator, and has never split the difference. Negotiate like your life depends on it. And it just gave me a vocabulary that allowed me to be more emotionally intelligent. And then coupling that with what I now call the LEARNT method, LLEARNT, on how to take a guest from, or anybody, guest or an employee, from upset to happy in one conversation. That's all psychology. You listen and label them and empathize and apologize, resolve the situation, notify all the people that need to know about this, and then thank the guest for bringing it, or the employee. And I tell them that I admire their courage for coming and talking to me about this. But when people get emotionally hijacked, the only way to reconnect them to the reality is through understanding psychology and taking them through a process. And some people do this organically and naturally. And for me, it had to be almost like step by step. This is step one. I need to listen to them. And step two, I need to empathize with them and those things. But man, the psychology of dealing with people that is by far what I spend most of my time doing, no matter if they are a guest or an employee.
Amen.
Yeah. So listen, if you don't have a copy of Sean's book, get one today. And if you're not listening to Sean's podcast, then subscribe. Sean, thank you so much again for coming on the show. Thank you so much.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. I love it. You and I get going, and like we said, we just can't stop.
Scott loves answering questions, so please reach out to Scott, thegmcoach.com, where you can find all of his hiring tools, free downloads, and social media contact information. Scott's consulting services include everything from one-on-one coaching to group training and corporate keynote speaking. Please like, rate, comment, and subscribe on iTunes so that we can help Scott create brand new leaders in the restaurant world. This podcast has been produced by Jennifer Heathers Eon of Beer Talk Radio, 900 East Karen Avenue, Suite H208 in Las Vegas, Nevada.